Let me start this talk by thanking the organizers for the nice invitation to this conference. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today. I changed a little bit the title to be a little bit more general, and I'm going to talk about quantum spin dynamics, coherence, and entanglement in trapped ions arrays. And what I want to tell you is a little bit of the recent progress that we have done in very close collaboration with the Penning trapped ion group at NIST in Boulder. So I want to start by just acknowledging my collaboration. So these experiments were done in the NIST Penning Trapped group, led by John Bollinger, and in particular, I'm going to highlight Justin Bonnet. He was the person who did most of the experiments that I'm going to talk about today. And I want to acknowledge also my theory postdocs, in particular Michael Work and Martin Garnett, as well as my FOS5, who is now in ARL. All right, so my talk is going to be on non-equilibrium quantum matter, and I think we know that non-equilibrium quantum systems are ubiquitous in matter in nature, and that we find it in not only in physics, biology, so understanding the behavior of non-equilibrium quantum matter is fundamental and can have great applications for quantum technologies, precision measurements. But the problem that we face when we are trying to model non-equilibrium quantum systems is that in general they are really complex and they are strongly correlated. So we find them very strongly correlated. And the issue is that, we cannot necessarily find very easily numerical methods that can deal with those systems. And all the standard techniques that we use to model equilibrium systems don't apply in this case. So really we need to develop new methodologies to understand their behavior. However, we are now at very exciting times. I'm a little bit biased because I'm only showing atomic systems, but I think that now the time is right because all these experiments are opening us a window trying to explore non-equilibrium dynamics in very different perspectives and arenas. So not only we are now with the possibility to try to understand strongly interacting correlated systems exhibiting contact interactions, very short-range interactions, but now the experiments are allowing us to open a window towards the exploration of more complex interactions that are long-range. So this is going to be mostly the topic of this talk, and in particular, I'm going to be focusing in trapped ions arrays. That is very similar experience that what we heard from Paul last talk. So we have long-range interacting systems, and one of the questions that I would be delighted to understand is how fast entanglement and correlations propagate in the presence of long-range interactions in contrast with short-range interacting systems. So there is a lot of understanding that we have gained in the behavior of short interactions. And I think there is a lot of questions that we don't know how to answer in long-range interacting systems. So this is the type of questions that I hopefully can intrigue you and try to give some answers to them. They are important because they can set the speed limits for quantum state transfer and thermalization in long-range interacting systems. And also, what is the complexity that one faces when we are trying to simulate this type of system with a classical computer. Some of the most challenging tasks is that they are entangled, but how we can characterize the multiple particle entanglement that is embedded in those systems. And in particular, when we are dealing with experiments, what happens with this entanglement in the presence of the coherence? So this is the list of questions I will try to discuss a little bit in the system. So the system that I have in mind is an array of 2D arrays of trapped ions. They form a triangular lattice because of the column interaction, because of the column repulsion. They form these 2D arrays, and in particular, what the systems that we have in mind, in contrast to prior talk, are those that, where the trapping is done with a Penning trap that is a set of cylindrical electrodes that provide both axial and radial confinement. So the radial confinement is done by a set of cylindrical electrodes that create very strong confinement along the axial direction, and the radial confinement is done through the Lorentz force that is generated by a very strong magnetic field, the superconducting. We have a superconducting magnet for Tesla in the presence of a rotating of the rotation that is generated by a rotating wall. So this creates this confinement radial and axial, and the image describes these very beautiful arrays where we can change the number of ions from 20 to 200, for example. Well, so now the system in consideration are the, where we want to encode at the spin degrees of freedom, are the hyperfine states of beryllium, so beryllium ions. These two hyperfine states are separated by hundreds of gigahertz in the presence of this strong magnet. And what we can do is that we can control these individual spins, do single qubit rotations by a very high fidelity by applying microwaves. So we have control of single qubit dynamics, but we want to also generate many body dynamics. And this is done by coupling, as was explained in the, by the prior speaker, by coupling the spin with the motion. So in the case of the pinning trap, we do by applying two far-detuned Raman beams that interfere with a beating node, nu, and this creates kind of a moving lattice. So this moving lattice is chosen such that the frequency and the polarization of the Raman beams generate a spin-dependent force. And this is dependent, spin-dependent force has a frequency that is tuned to excite the phonon modes of the crystal, the transverse modes of the crystal. The idea is that these phonons are what are going to mediate very long-range interactions between the ions. Let me try to explain a little bit more detail. So this is the type of Hamiltonian that is generated by the optical dipole force. So you see that has a frequency determined by the meeting node of these two Raman beams and has, in the lambda regime, a coupling between the C position of the ion J and its corresponding spin at the C direction. So what we do, therefore, is that this C position of the ion can be spun in terms of the normal modes of the crystal that can be computed classically by just looking at the equilibrium position of the ions in terms of the column repulsion and the trapping frequencies. So you get a gonalized Hamiltonian and can compute the set of eigenfrequencies and normal modes. These are classical drum head modes. I tried to do an schematic here, and maybe with this movie you can see that are the different drum head modes associated with the crystal. They have a set of frequency here. And what we want to tune is this laser, the beating node, to excite them. So depending on how close you excite those different modes, you can either excite only one or most of them. So one of the beauty of this Hamiltonian is you can classify this as a spin boson Hamiltonian in some degree. And the advantage is that this Hamiltonian admits an exact solution. So when you write the time order propagator, actually it exactly cuts at second order. So we can rightly write in this case a propagator that has two components. One that couples spin and the phonons. This is the one that entangles spin with the phonons, and we don't want that part. And the one that generates spin-spin interactions, this is the second order term of this Hamiltonian. And what we want to actually do is try to use this as the dominant component. So one way to make it dominant is trying to have a large detuning such that the phonons can be adiabatically eliminating. That's one possibility. That's what is used, for the prior speaker discussed. The other possibility that is what we are going to use in this talk and that allows us to generate almost long-range interactions is by just stereoscopically so only measuring at the stereoscopic points where the spin and the phonon decouple. So the type of interactions that we generate are spin-spin interactions, where, as I said, this coupling constant depends on the mode structure, the frequencies, and the resonance of the beating node frequency. Depending on how resonant you are from the different modes, you can generate power law interactions so that depends on the tuning from the center of mass. This is the most relevant case for this talk. When you are very close to the center of mass, then you are only talking to the center of mass mode. That means in this case, all the crystal goes back and forth collectively, and this is what mediates these long-range interactions between the ions. Then as you start to zoom farther, farther away, most of the modes start to participating, and then you can generate more type of power law type interactions. So these are, for example, the points calculated by solving the eigenstates of these 2D crystals, and these are fitting to just a power law type of interactions that I agree quite well. Yes, so this is the case when I'm going to concentrate, and interactions can be up to almost dipole-dipole coupling with alpha equal to 3. All right, so how we are going to characterize the dynamics? So I'm going to give you an AMO perspective and a condensed matter perspective. For the AMO perspective, we are going to use what is used for clocks, that is Ramsey spectroscopy. So the basic idea is that we can prepare all the ions in a very well, in a pure state, for example, all the ions pointing down, and then we apply a rotation with the microwaves that make all the ions pointing along the x direction. Then we are going to let the system evolve during the interacting Hamiltonian. I'm going to then to rotate and accumulate a phase that determines of these interactions. And finally, I want to read this phase and translate it in population, my measures, observables like the population after this rotation. In the experiment, we need to apply some echo pulse in the middle just to avoid single particle decoherence term effects that are always present in the experiment. But basically, this is the sequence that we are going to use. And the idea of the sequence is that we want to verify the spin model, create strong correlations, and go to regimes that are intractable to theory. For the condensed matter perspective, this Hamiltonian can be seen more like a quench. So basically, you prepare the system all pointing along the x direction. Here, it's like you have a very strong magnetic field pointing along the x direction. Suddenly, you quench the magnetic field, turn it off, and then you have only the evolution of the interaction Hamiltonian. And then you measure some type of observables. All right, so the case, as I said, that we are going to focus is when all the interactions are the same. So you generate the Hamiltonian can be regrouped in terms of collective of spin observables, when each spin is talking to each other the same, so it's collective. And this generates the one-axis twisting Hamiltonian that is proportional to LC squared. So you might think this is very trivial, all to all interactions, I see model. What can we learn about this system? But actually, if you try to use mean field theory to describe the dynamics of this Hamiltonian, so in the mean field theory, each the effect of the other ions is to generate an effective magnetic field that depends on the SC projection of the rest of the ions. So the magnetic field is just proportional to cos theta, the projection along the C direction. And if you set theta equal to pi half, that is the case when the system is pointing along the X direction, you find that there is no dynamics. So at the mean field theory, you don't have any dynamics. And the question, therefore, if there is dynamics, then it should be driven by correlations and how much these correlations are going to build up in the system. As in any quantum quench, the idea is that even if you start with a product state that is trivial, as the system evolves, a global unitarity can create highly entangled states. And this degree of entanglement can be characterized, can induce some effect of a local thermalization, where initially you can describe each component of your system as isolated, but as the system evolves, then each local subsystems of the collective global system gets entangled with the rest, and this is the idea or gate idea of a thermalization, local thermalization, and this coupling between a subsystem with the rest. It is well characterized by a type of measurement that is the entanglement entropy. And one of the measurements that has been very useful and demonstrated even in recent experimental measurements is the Rayleigh entropy that measures the purity of the subsets of the system. So you want to measure the purity of a sub-block of your system. This is my system A that has some length. So for example, if I start with a product state, then I don't lose any information by tracing the rest of the system, and you have a zero entanglement entropy. But as you evolve and get recorrelated, then you can have an entanglement entropy that can grow as a function of the length of the system, as you become highly entangled. So we're dealing with a simpler Hamiltonian that we can actually analytically compute. And the question is, how much of this phenomena is exceeded by the collective Ising model? But in fact, instead of splitting the 2 to the n Hilbert space, you have a smaller system that is a Dicke manifold where you can almost do everything analytically. So is there any type of thermalization in the system? Well, let's start to look at. So imagine that we choose as a single one block of the system and see how much this block thermalizes by talking to the rest of the system. So when you compute the entanglement, the one block entanglement entropy or Rayne entropy, what you find that this is completely related with the collective magnetization of the system. So this is one-to-one correspondent to this. This is another measurement of this one block purity or entanglement entropy is also called one tangle. And what you see is that when you compute this SX, this one entangle, you see that it grows at a very short times and reaches the maximum value of a mixed state for this ICE model also. And this is very closely related, as we see from this formula, with the behavior of the collective magnetization that exhibits some very quick collapse. It collapses, then reaches zero, and actually many things are happening in the middle that we cannot read because we are just reading a single particle observable. But here, for example, at the middle of the evolution, you form a highly entangled cat state in the middle. For our parameters, this state cat time proportional to the number of particles, so it takes a long time to form, but in principle, very non-trivial states are formed, and then you have a revival, in this case, with the opposite magnetization. So you can do the same story not only for the one block, but the two-block system, and you are going to see again that there is a fast growth and some saturation actually close to the maximum value that you can expect from the system. So there is non-trivial entanglement that is generated even in this all-to-all-icing mode. Instead of looking at this, when we are looking at the two-point correlations that are what characterize these two-block bipartition, a more general entanglement witness that has been used in the experiments is called spin squeezing. So spin squeezing is a useful entanglement witness in the sense that it is a witness that actually works even in systems that are not pure. So I have to say that entanglement entropy is an entanglement measurement only when you have pure systems. In this case, this measurement is more general. Also, it's useful for precision measurements because it can tell you what is the phase sensitivity, enhanced phase sensitivity of your system, how much you gain spectroscopically by creating an entangled state. However, it has the limitation that is only a good witness when you start working, when we use Gaussian states. So the idea that how you can see that the system gets a squeeze is the very simple physical picture that you are rotating with a magnetic field that depends on its C. That means the sign is different in the North Pole and in the South Pole, and the speed increases as you go closer to the North Pole and decreases at the equator. So during the dynamics, the initial coherent state that has an spherical noise gets distorted, elongated, and this is what you get some type of squeezing. Like this, and the point is that, however, this squeezing only survives for short time. So this squeezing only survives for short time, and at some point you are wrapping around the sphere, and you see that you increase some minimal squeezing at some time that is much more shorter than the cat state time. But at some point you are going to do the squeezing. Start to grow, so you are losing the entanglement, but you are losing the squeezing, but doesn't mean that you are losing the entanglement in your system. It's just that your state is becoming non-Gaussian. So basically, that's the idea. So for the experimental comparisons, we want to start by measuring those observables, and something that we have to be aware and is that in the experiment we do suffer for decoherence mainly coming from light scattering. So for us, it's not going to work that you solve for the Hamiltonian evolution. We have to deal with the full open quantum system dynamics. So the three type of, a type of Liouvillean type master equation works. So, and in this case, we have three important jump operators that we have to consider. That is a defacing, that is Rayleigh scattering, that is just proportional to sigma c jump operator. This introduces some type of exponential decays and can be handled analytically very easy. However, there are two types of defacing mechanisms, spontaneous emission and absorption. They do not commute with the Hamiltonian, so in principle, the dynamics is not that trivial. However, due to the, there is the possibility to actually solve them and include them exactly. And then this is what the solution that was derived by Michael Fosfay, where he really derived an exact solution of the icing model in the presence of any type of these type of processes. That's what we have using to actually model the experiment. So we can compute any order of correlation functions in the presence of these three types of decoherence. So let's go and see the experiment. So I mentioned that the first kind of entanglement witness is when you trace over only one block, that is, and is X, the polarization is what gives you some information of the entanglement that is built up. You have to be a little bit careful because even just the decoherent processes can reduce the contrast of your SX. So for that, what we have done is also these dots, these squares, are just the decay when you don't have any type of interactions, or this is what you get from the mean field theory. So the dynamics only cause informed defacing. However, what we did in the experiment is to change the number of ions from 21 to, 200. So here we are only showing to 150 approximately. And what we see is that the decay is much more faster than what you see from the non-interacting case. And moreover, the decay of the of SX actually obeys a universal scaling that depends on the number of particles. So when we collapse this data, we can see that actually it obeys the exponential scaling that we expect. And moreover, you can see that as time goes on, the decay is just you expect that the decay is really associated with this wrapping around of the noise distribution. These solid lines agree very well with the experiment and their exact solutions, including full decoherence process. So we do see beyond infield effects. The next type of observable that we look in the experiment is the squeezing. And in this case, what happens is we look at an array of 86 ions, and what we see is how this noise was wrapping around. So you see that you have a squeezing, squeezing along one direction and anti-squeezing along the other direction as a function of time. So the solid line is the theory with decoherence. The dots are the experiment. There is this uncertainty because they cannot actually measure the tomographic angle completely accurate. So the angle that you need to rotate to get the optimal squeezing or anti-squeezing. So there is some 5% uncertainty. This is as a function of time. We can see also as the function of this tomographic angle for different times. And we see that for short times, you get the maximum squeezing. Again, this is theories with and without the coherence. As you have a squeezing and then start to over squeeze, and then as you go longer and longer times, you don't see a squeezing anymore, partly from the decoherence, partly from the fact that you become a non-Gaussian. Okay, so this is great. It's telling us the experiment can see some type of entanglement, but so far I think these type of tools have been standardly used in atomic systems. So the question is if we can try to go beyond and try to see entanglement beyond one or two blocks subsystems. And just as an schematic or so theoretically, we can plot, for example, what would the entanglement entropy when you partite the system in half of your system would look like as a function of time. T is the cut state time. So you can see this is for two different system sizes normalized by the maximum value, and you do see a fast growth of entanglement entropy at short times for here, and you see a complicated dynamics in the middle. So all these structures that you are developing here is when you have the cut state. The cut state is actually has lower entanglement entropy because only involved two, the Smith decomposition is only two. So you can see that it drops here. But it's not, the dynamics is not trivial, and you try to see how the entanglement entropy behaves as a function of the size of the bipartition, you see that you see some linear growth. So this is a system for the particle. You see kind of a linear growth of the entanglement entropy for almost local systems. So there is something going on. There is a question that I was very curious and I want to share with you. So how fast entangle How much fast entanglement develops in the icing care compared to other collective models? Somehow, we might tend to think that the icing model is trivial. And just to show, for example, the comparison between the collective icing and the collective icing plus transverse field, and you can try to compare the entanglement, the purity at a half of the system, and the ratio between these two for different values of the transverse field as a function of time. And interestingly, you see that in most of the time, you see blue, meaning that the icing has more entanglement in all these blue regions than the transverse field. So only at very, very short time, you see higher entanglement from the transverse field, and also at the case when you form the cat state, that you have lower entanglement in the icing case. But overall, you can see that, in fact, there is significant entanglement built up even in the icing model. So the question is, can we try to access this entanglement built up somehow in the experiment? And well, when we were thinking about how to measure that, then it came a very nice literature discussion about scrambling in quantum information in quantum systems. So scrambling is the way that quantum information after a quench can be redistributed, spread over the collective, over the system degrees of freedom, and can be lost if you look at just a local degrees of freedom. So the information is scrambled over your system. And actually, it's very closely related to, the thermalization and the generation of entanglement entropy in some part of the system. Actually, there has been very nice connection between entanglement and classical chaos and scrambling. There are very nice work in Princeton, Stanford, and also there has been very proof of principle experiment in superconducting qubits when they try to show the connection between entanglement and chaos.
I see, okay.
Well, but we now have seen in the experiment, so yeah. Now there has been pointed out that the scrambling can have some important connection with quantum gravity, because black holes are the systems that scramble the information fastest, and there has been some proofs that actually the scrambling time is determined by the temperature only of the black hole. So that's very nice. But I think there has been pointed out, and I'm going to discuss, that one way to measure to get information about the scrambling is measuring some specific time of out of time order correlations. I'm going to discuss them, but something that I want to emphasize is that most of this behavior has been discussed for systems that thermalizes, where the only parameter that determines the scrambling time is the temperature. For systems that are pure, that has more complicated dynamics where the scrambling time is not necessarily determined by the temperature but details of the Hamiltonian, there is still a lot of open questions. So can we try to understand a little bit these type of ideas better? So one of the observables to measure scrambling is, as I said, this time of out of time order correlations. And these are our time order correlations are correlations that involve two commuting operators, B and W. And the way that is defined the OTOC is this expectation value that involves this application of these four times of these operators, where B is a static time, but W is the Heisenberg operator. So we evolve this W with the many-body Hamiltonian. And the idea is that this out-of-time order correlation is measuring the degree at which the non-commutativity of the system develops, because the W is getting correlations induced by this Hamilton, the interacting Hamilton. So the fact that this F measures the non-commutativity is because there is a one-to-one relation between the F and the commutator between these two. So if F equal to, so at, yes, at zero time there is commutativity, at time equal to zero there is, they commute, but at longer times they do not. And the question is, can we access them in an experiment? So the answer is yes. There are some special cases of correlations that we, our autocorrelation that we can access in the experiment, and this is what we have done. So what we are going to use is the fact that we can reverse Sorry. Then he mentioned that actually we are not the only ones. Of course, they have been prior very nice proposals, and most likely we are going to hear from Mohammed or from Norm about measuring out of time correlation functions by using control spins. And there was a very nice proposal by Monica, and we most likely will hear from her using echoes. The implementation that we are going to use is slightly different, but very related. So what we have done use the echo, the Benevoli echo idea. So basically we use the fact that the coupling constant in the Hamiltonian is inversely proportional to the detuning from the center of mass mode. So we can change the detuning from positive to negative, and because we have the system all to all, then we can really change the sign of the Hamiltonian and do a many body echo. So the basic idea is that we prepare the spins all down, and then we apply global rotation to initialize the system with all the spins pointing along the x direction. So we have a pure initial density matrix with all the spins along x. This is the plus. Then what we do is that we do this procedure. So we apply the evolution. Then in the middle, we apply another evolution, operation that is a rotation along the x direction by some angle phi. And then we measure and we detect two different types of observables. Notice first that if you don't apply any rotation here, we just do and undo the Hamiltonian. And this allows us to classify, understand the purity of our system. So, I mean, how other the coherence mechanism and affecting our dynamics. So if there is perfect evolution, we should get we could completely undo the evolution. So what we have measured here first, if one not observable, is the fidelity of to remain in the initial state. So this is one of the observables, the projection of on rho zero. And this can be easily, well, not easily, but it can be accessed in the Trabagnon experiments because they can actually resolve the probability of being in the dark state. So when they don't have any photon cones, they cannot resolve one spin flip, but they can resolve the probability to remain dark. And this is what it has measured. So the observable is the probability to remain dark. You evolve the Hamiltonian, do the rotation, do the Hamiltonian, and that's the observable. You can see that you can non-trivially put an operator here because the initial density matrix, this is exactly the identity. So by doing this protocol, we are measuring an autop where the B is the projection on the D is the initial density matrix of the system, and W is the rotation along the X direction. So that's one of the protocol that we did. And notice that we are measuring fidelity, so this quantity is highly sensitive to decoherence. Now, the other observable that we measure is magnetization. So in the case of the all-to-all Hamiltonian, when you have permutational symmetry, then if you measure, so the information of xi is exactly the information of the total magnetization divided by n. So our measurement is related to this magnetization of the spin I, and we do exactly along the x direction, we do exactly the same protocol. Again, we can insert an observable in the middle initially because everything is pointing along the x direction, and we have measured an auto where B is sigma x and W is the rotation. So this is the experiment that we did, but let me say that this is not new. So actually, the inspiration for measuring this protocol was already in the literature. There was pioneer in an NMR experiment, and this is nothing else that they call multiple quantum coherence experiments. So basically, the idea in an NMR system is they start, well, in contrast to our case, they have mostly a statistical mixture with a small polarization magnetization along, for example, the Z direction. They do, instead of, they do a Hamiltonian, this is the double quantum Hamiltonian that creates pairs of spin flips. This is exactly what we do with our Ising Hamiltonian along the x direction. If you think that the gesture is along the x direction, sigma 6, sigma c, what it does is creates pairs of spin flips, so nothing different. Well, the range of the interactions is the only difference. They do the rotation, they undo the Hamiltonian, and they measure the projection of the initial, over the initial density matrix. So for them, measuring a C and the projection of the initial density matrix is exactly the same. For us, it's slightly different. but it's, we are following the, what they taught us to do. And actually, they have a very nice ways to analyze these autochs. So what they do is they analyze them in thinking about the development of multiple quantum coherences. So what they do is that they divide the density matrix of the systems into sub-blocks that have different coherences. So for example, the diagonals have m equal to 0, but the, this is an example for three spins, but for example, the edges, I mean, you have the projection between down, 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 and up, 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 these have the maximum number of spin flips. So you can classify your density matrix in terms of how many different spin flips are you are involved in the system, and this so you can go from m, from minus n to n. This is exact. So you graph your density matrix in this way, and what you do is that initially you start with m equal to 0, and as a time evolves, you are flipping pairs of spins, and when you are flipping pairs of the spins, what you have is that you are measuring how many, well, you are measuring, you are having access to these multiple quantum intensities. And what we do is that we do the Fourier transform of them, and we get information about these ions. So how much time? Huh? Oh, no, but I started 5 minutes, 10 minutes later. Well, very quickly. I'm just going to measure, well, 5 minutes. 5 minutes, I would. So what I just want to show is that these IMs have information of these coherences developing the density matrix. So you can see here for six spins that you have all m equal to 0, and you develop and have information of the mapping of the density matrix. And this is what happens when you have 100 spins. That's how the different Fourier components develop as a function of time. And here you develop a cat state. For when you measure the IEMs, that is only the magnetization, you are not measuring the BULAB of many-body correlations, but the multiparticle coherence, but the BULAB of many-body correlations. So you can show for the Ising model that AM is going to be non-zero if you're having your Hamiltonian, a term that couples M spins. So for example, if you have nearest neighbor, you are only going to develop three lines in these coherences. This is what you see, you expect to see if you have the case of the collective Ising model, how the IMs will develop as a function of time. It looks like a line, well, yes, it's like a line cone, but it's, of course, it's different measurements. So let me say that we have measured this multiple quantum coherence in the experiment. So we have measured the fidelity, and we have seen up to the development of to I4, not only so m equal to 4, that are significant. Here in this case, everything is strongly damped because you have very fast decoherence in the fidelity, but still we can see some development of coming from the pure evolution. We measure this magnetization. This also as a function of different times. We have very good agreement between theory and experiment, and we can see the development onto m equal 8 significant correlations. So we are really looking at the evolution of the experiment. The solid lines are the theory with a, so for to really reproduce them, we have to include phonons and decoherence. And just let me say, I'm going to skip that, but that these IEMs are good characterization entanglement witness. Actually, they give access to the Fisher information. They give access to themselves that can be used as different entanglement witness. But something that I want to finish this is by showing the comparison between I0 and the Rényi entropy. So you can see that there is a one-to-one correspondence between these two. Actually, it's not a coincidence because it has been predicted that the autochs can measure the entanglement, the purity of the system, when you are the W is a complete set of operators. Here we are not doing over a complete set of operators, but only some rotations that are not complete set of those operators. But still, we can have some access to the entanglement entropy. So with that, I just let me finish that we have implement time reversal Ising interactions into the arrays of 100 ions, observe spin squeezing, measure autochs, and the fusion directions are the transverse field. And hopefully we can mitigate the coherence, and we can try to access single ion readout. And with that, let me thank you for your attention.
Okay, questions to Ana Maria? So I'm wondering if you can comment on what I expect decoherence to do to these multiple quantum coherences.
Yes, yes. So actually, this is something that we have to analyze very carefully. And one, the connection between the Fourier transform of the, so this formula that connects the multiple quantum coherence to the, so the observable that we measure with the multiple quantum coherence. This formula, in principle, will break down in general in the case of the coherence because one evolution is different to the other. However, we find that for the specific kind of the coherence that we have, where the spontaneous emission and the spontaneous absorption are the same, actually the coherence is diagonal in the different blocks of the is diagonal with the different sublocks of the coherences. So the noise doesn't couple different sublocks. And because of this U1 property, then you can show that for this kind of noise, it's just going to generate an overall decay, but it's not going to still, this type of relation is actually valid.
Noise, just the decoherence type noise?
No, the spontaneous emission and absorption. So you have the decoherence from the phase, and you have a spontaneous emission and spontaneous absorption. But the fact that the emission and absorption are the same preserves the U1 of the Lubilian, in the Lubilian space, and therefore the mapping is not that badly affected. So you can see that when you look at the dynamics with and without decoherence, that the coherence is not completely changing the dynamics in our system. It's really reducing the signal. That's what we can only see up to I4. It should be much more larger. So the time that we will need to see all of this is, we have to significantly reduce the coherence because it's multiplied by N. But besides the reduction of the signal, we do still can infer something about the development.
Why does it seem better with 100 compared to 48? So if there's no decoherence, all of them would go up to 1, right, at the highest points. Is that true?
What do you mean? No. So this is as a function of time, and this is as a function. So this 0.3, 0.5, 0.7, and the contrast is decreasing, as you are seeing, as a function of time.
So this is expected from the quantum dynamics.
Yes. So they should decay as e to the minus gamma n t because of the coherence only. If you don't have the coherence, what happens actually in, for example, it's clear here that yes, so some of the lower m decay. And the larger m, so meaning that the information is going from the local observables to the higher order observables. So you see, for example, as a function of time, that the smaller m's, so at some point this decay, and this other, so in the theory you can see it better, this small m decays, and the larger m grow, just transferring the correlations, so the information is building up in higher order correlations.
I guess I'm wondering, so like from these curves on the top, it seems like the contrast is always better, no matter which time. I mean, of course, it gets a little bit worse as time goes on, but they more or less go up to close to 1.8 or something.
Well, at time equal to, when there is no rotation, then it's not, so that you are not doing anything to your Hamiltonian. So then you expect to have, so yes, so you can see what, so you start, you have some small decay, but if we are measuring kind of the purity of our system. You are doing and undoing the evolution without rotation in the middle. So you expect to have almost no decay at zero rotation, and same as pi. So it's kind of, but the point when you start to do the rotation in the middle, this is when you are changing your Hamiltonian. So the first part becomes different to the second part, and this is where you can measure this build-up of correlation.
Thank you.
So I have a question, actually two related questions. Is it correct, in your experiment where it's essentially like a big spin because of the all-to-all interactions, mm-hmm. can I think of the multiple coherence analysis as basically measuring whether you have delocalization in this single particle space of MZ.
Yes, in the collective M.
Collective
yes.
M, and basically it's measuring this kind of single particle localization. But in a more chaotic system where you have some spatial structure or disorder or something like this, then how sensitive would such a multiple coherence analysis be to the preciseness in which you implement the negative time evolution? Whether it will all be completely lost if you don't really do it very, very precisely?
Yes, so I think it's going to be affected. So it's going to be, so in our case, it's even not perfect because so we have some coupling with the phonons, and this is one of the sources of the coherence. But it's true that when you go to the disorder case, you have to be more, you have to be more careful how you implement the do and undo of the noise.
The question is whether it's exponentially exponentially sensitive because of quantum chaos, or there is
depends. So I can show you. this is for example, we have been studying what happens when you have we have done some calculations when you have ice random and not random. So this is not the case, but at very short times, actually, you can show that the random model behaves very similar to the collective model if you use an effective coupling constant. So it depends on the time what you are looking at. So at very short times, the randomicity doesn't care that much because at some point you are coupling, you are measuring an effective coupling constant. But at longer times, where I have this? Okay, here. So at short time, so this is the comparison between the uniform and the random. For example, the magnetization, well, doesn't care, but when you look at the I zeros, you see that they're going to be very similar at very short times. So, or the entropy. At very short times, they're going to be only similar, and then they depart significantly at longer times. So it's a concern, but you have to be very careful how to implement the experiment and how to judge what you see.
There are more questions? There are no more questions. Let's thank Ana Maria Rey. I guess there is lunch. Courtyard.